Welcome to our presentation in the Food Principles module on FODMAPs. You'll soon be learning what that odd word means if you don't already know what it means. Something to consider when you're looking at people's digestion and helping them to create a healthy diet. We have a guest today doing our presentation, a very special guest who is one of our nutritional endocrinology practitioners, Steph Jackson. And Steph is the founder of the Core Reset Program and the Functional Probiotics Program. And her specialty is working with the digestion and the organisms in the digestion and helping people to heal their digestive tracts and leaky guts. So we're really, really excited to have Steph here today to discuss that. But before we get right into it, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, just what you should and shouldn't say when you're talking to people. So we'll go to the disclaimer slide, which talks about how basically this isn't intended to replace one-on-one care. So when you're working with somebody and you're helping them to identify sensitivities to certain foods and food groups and help them to put together a healing diet, that you're basically not giving them medical advice. You're basically just from your own research and from your own clinical experience and from what you've learned throughout our program, you're helping them to become educated about like the owner's guide to the body, how they use their body and how they work with their body. And if they're on any medications at all, or if they're under the care of a doctor, please make sure that you encourage them to run any changes by their doctor before they make wholesale changes to the diet. So I'm going to have Steph just take it away.
Thank you, Dr. Eatery, and thank you for this. This is fun. It's an honor to be doing this presentation. Right, so FODMAPs, a little bit of history on FODMAPs first. So they were discovered after the SCD and GAPS diets were developed. And the low FODMAP diet was developed in 1999 at Monash University in Australia by Susan Shepherd and Peter Gibson, and it was developed for celiac disease patients to see if it would help them reduce their symptoms. So what are FODMAPs? They're fermentable, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. The low FODMAP diet can be helpful for those with IBS symptoms, those with Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, leaky gut, celiac disease, and really any kind of gas and bloating digestive symptoms. The clients typically affected would be those that experience gas and bloating within 3 hours of eating. Those that have gas, bloating, or leaky gut, or known leaky gut, a history of any kind of irritable bowel syndrome, multiple food allergies, celiac disease, a diagnosis of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or a history of IBS or IBD. Here are some FODMAP intolerance symptoms. Gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation, burping, abdominal pain, or again, a diagnosis of SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Let's understand how these foods that are high in the FODMAP carbohydrates create symptoms. Really, gas in the digestive system is created through fermentation. It's created by bacteria and yeast fermenting stuff in there. Foods will be fermented if they're poorly digested. So if we don't digest them, the organisms in our guts will adapt to do so for us. Bacteria in our digestive tracts will adapt to ferment anything that we can't digest, which is great in the large intestine. So what do we mean by fermentable? The high FODMAP foods are poorly absorbed in the intestinal tract, and they can feed bacteria. Again, which is great in the large intestine, but in the small intestine where we're meant to be absorbing a lot of our nutrients and where the pH is more important, more delicate, this can be a problem. A wide variety of bacteria can ferment FODMAPs. Fermentation in the large intestine is normal. Fermentation in the small intestine creates gas and bloating that will be noticeable soon after eating. So some bacteria have enzymes that will produce enzymes to break down these slightly more complex sugars. And then really all the bacteria and yeast just want to eat glucose. And so, you know, any kind of carbohydrate is fine by them. And it's just because these are the ones that that are so commonly not digested well that they're put together in this diet? Oligosaccharides. So oligo, meaning a few, a small amount of saccharides, more than disaccharides, but not as many as polysaccharides. There's fructans and fructo-oligosaccharides, and there's galactans and galacto-oligosaccharides. There's some stuff missing from this slide, but I'm just going with it. So fructo-oligosaccharides are chains of fructose molecules with a glucose molecule at the end. And some examples of foods that are high in fructo-oligosaccharides are wheat, onions, green onions, but like the bulb part, garlic, leeks, legumes, peas, dried beans, and lentils, cabbages, Brussels sprouts, artichokes, beets, asparagus, chicory, dandelion, inulin, and fructo-oligosaccharides, like you can buy them as a supplement. So also in this category of oligosaccharides are galacto-oligosaccharides and galactans. And so these can be in milk, in sugar beets, Jerusalem artichokes, and they're manufactured, you know, in the bodies of mammals during lactation as glucose is converted to galactose. So some examples are chickpeas, lentils, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, legumes, and green beans. So keeping in mind, when we're giving these examples, these foods also contain other carbohydrates in the FODMAP spectrum and other carbohydrates in general. So here are all of our oligosaccharide examples: onions, green onions, garlic, leeks, peas, legumes, lentils, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, artichokes, beets, asparagus, chicory, dandelion, inulin, chickpeas, green beans, beans of other types, wheat, soy, and fructo-oligosaccharide powders and like inulin supplements. Just take note that these carbohydrates are water-soluble. So tea made from any of these things, or soup, broth made from any of these things, is also going to contain these oligosaccharides. Here's a nice example of an oligosaccharide-rich meal, hummus. So if you have a client who, you know, has gas and bloating after eating hummus, you know, they might be allergic to sesame or chickpeas, or they might just not deal well with oligosaccharides. And these are not all that digestible by anybody. And again, that's great in the large intestine. And as we'll get into a bit later in the presentation, when the bacteria in the small intestine start to eat these foods for us, that is when we experience the symptoms. Disaccharides include lactose, sucrose, maltose, and isomaltose. So this includes, you know, table sugar. Lactose intolerance, I'm sure that you've heard of. And so this is kind of the lactose level of some common foods. So 1 milligram of lactose is going to be in 2 tablespoons of cottage cheese, a tablespoon of cream or sour cream, or a teaspoon of cream cheese. So you might have a client that can tolerate like a teaspoon of cream cheese, which makes me want to say, what's the point? All right, here's some examples of disaccharides. Foods that are high in disaccharides, again, they will contain a spectrum of carbohydrates, but they're particularly high in these ones: sweet potato, turnips, pears, camut and spelt, edamame, raw broccoli, pickles or pickled foods, malted grains. So how they malt grains, in particular in wheat, what they will do is they will sprout it and dehydrate it. And I don't know about you, but I like to make a lot of raw crackers sometimes, and I will take pseudo grains and I will sprout them and dehydrate them. And so, you know, for some people, because this does convert some of the sugars in there, this might be a problem. So good diet diary for your clients is essential. Kiwis, wheat, corn, peas. Here's an example of a disaccharide-rich meal of pea and corn salad. Right, monosaccharides, glucose, fructose, and galactose. So about fructose. Fructose means sugars derived from fruits. And the low FODMAP diet is really a low fructose diet, or a balanced fructose diet between fructose and glucose, rather than a no fructose diet. The digestive tract has both fructose and glucose transporters for absorption. But fructose is horribly absorbed when it's isolated from glucose. When it's on its own, it's poorly absorbed. So in cases like high fructose corn syrup, agave syrup, even the coconut nectar, these things can be poorly absorbed. But if the fructose is paired equally with glucose, or if there's less fructose than there is glucose in a particular meal, the glucose basically holds the fructose's hand and takes it across the intestinal barrier. So there's a piggyback effect. So there will be less digestive disturbance. So these symptoms can be super confusing for people. Cherries are a wonderful monosaccharide-rich meal. Keeping in mind, again, the bacteria, they want to eat glucose. And so any kind of sugar is going to feed bacteria. It's just the sugars that we don't absorb well that we're going to really notice, like the fructose when it's alone. All right, polyols. These are sugar alcohols that often end in an OL, and their molecule ends in an OH, which is what the alcohol is all about. So you can find them in some sugar-free foods and a lot of, you know, diabetic chocolates or things like this that are advertised that way. They're naturally occurring in many fruits and vegetables. For more information about these carbohydrates, I highly recommend that you check out the second presentation in the macronutrients carbohydrate module. There's some great information about exactly what the differences are between all sorts of carbohydrates. And here are some examples of polyols. Sugar alcohols like sorbitol, mannitol, maltitol, xylitol, and erythritol. And those that happen naturally in fruits like apples, apricots, blackberries, cherries, nectarines, lychees, pears, plums, prunes, watermelon, and avocado. And in vegetables like cauliflower, mushrooms, and snow peas. So it's a wonderful polyol-rich meal, mushrooms. So here are some mistakes that I see over and over again that I would love for us to have super clear. Fruits contain both glucose and fructose. Da-da-da-da! Yes, 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 and oftentimes more glucose than fructose, okay? Xylitol and erythritol are polyols, and the reason why they're magically low-carb is because we don't absorb them. Shirataki noodles are very, very high in FODMAPs. They're basically entirely FODMAP, which is why we don't absorb them. So anything that sort of seems like it should have a lot of carbs in it, but it magically doesn't, because by the time you're listening to this presentation, there's probably some new food on the market, or the PGX supplement. These are high in FODMAPs, and the reason why they are low in impact on our blood sugar is because they're not absorbed. So some differentiation between the GAPS diet, the SCD diet, and the low FODMAP diet. The GAPS diet removes disaccharides and polysaccharides, glucose, fructose, and galactose are allowed. So the monosaccharides are allowed. The SCD diet removes disaccharides and polysaccharides, and the monosaccharides are the only sugars allowed on both of those diets, theoretically. The low FODMAP diet lowers mono, di, and oligosaccharides, polyols, and lowers fructose as well. So these diets are actually very similar, but the way that they are implemented is different. And I believe that it is because of how they are taught. So while it's not implicit in the diet, the SDD diet and the GAPS diet quite often come along with a protocol to rebalance gut flora, to eat whole, natural foods, whereas sometimes the FODMAP diet, the focus is more on avoiding things, and there's not a lot of focus on rebuilding the gut population. In fact, quite often that's recommended to be avoided. The elemental diet and juice fasting, depending on the juice, or water fasting in particular, are also low FODMAP. And you know, quite often that is one of the reasons why clients experience a decrease in symptoms when they do a short water fast. Right. So fructose malabsorption and the gut-brain connection. Fructose malabsorption can reduce gut motility in the small intestine. It can decrease plasma tryptophan and thus serotonin. Low serotonin has been associated with anxiety, depression, and sleep issues. Individuals with autistic spectrum disorders have been shown to be deficient in fructose and glucose transporters. So again, individuals with autistic spectrum disorders have been shown to be deficient in fructose and glucose transporters. So the no or low fructose and the no or low glucose plan might be best for them. Really going to have to be individualized for each person. Here's a little picture of the absorption of glucose and fructose in the small intestine. Okay, so almost all edible plants contain FODMAPs. I actually can't think of an example that doesn't contain any type of FODMAP right now. FODMAPs are part of a range of carbohydrates. And FODMAPs are digested largely by something called brush border enzymes. Brush border enzyme production sort of equals FODMAP tolerance, along with chewing. You can see a picture here of the brush border, where the brush border enzymes are produced. And some examples are glucoamylase, also known as maltase, sucrase, which is also known as isomaltase, lactase, and peptidases, like amino or dipeptidase. There's another one called nucleosidase. Yeah, so those are the brush border enzymes. They're also responsible for gut motility. And we need good mucosa, good healthy digestive mucosa to be able to produce them. There's a lot going on there. So what are we really talking about? Now, the low FODMAP diet is most often used for people who have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or who suspect that they have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So what is this? I think there are four things that contribute to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth beyond the food. The first would be a lack of protective flora in the small intestine. The second would be the wrong environment in the small intestine. The third would be the presence of some kind of keystone troublemakers in terms of bacteria, the ones that are listed on the slide, among others. And the fourth would be reduced motility for any reason, whether it's caused by bacteria or fructose or a central nervous system issue. Right? So all of these things can produce, it's kind of like the SIBO recipe. And then they're just waiting to be fed. And so that's when we'll notice when we eat the FODMAPs that we get these symptoms. A lot of those bacteria, E. coli, Klebsiella, Clostridium, Staph, and Strep, they can produce D-lactic acid and change the environment in the small intestine. And in fact, so can a lot of the probiotics that we can purchase for our health. They can grow out of proportion, especially when the environment in the small intestine is incorrect, as in too acidic. They can reduce the mucosa and thus the brush border enzymes, decreasing our digestion of those FODMAP carbohydrates and leaving more for them. And of course, they can communicate with the immune system quite often to our detriment. And again, bacteria in the small intestine can eat all sugars. So they're going to eat glucose too. They're going to eat any kind of sugar. But we really notice the FODMAPs because we're not really able to digest them as well. Here are some of the symptoms of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Gas, bloating, fatigue, autoimmunity, fibromyalgia, nutrient deficiencies, of course, because we know that the amino acids and the minerals, these things need to be absorbed in the small intestine, pain in the digestive system, symptoms of irritable bowel, diarrhea or constipation. So your client may go for breath testing to determine whether or not they have SIBO or to see the extent of the bacteria overgrown in the small intestine. Breath testing can be used to diagnose SIBO or to determine intolerances to certain types of carbohydrates. Breath tests include the lactulose, lactose, glucose, and fructose test. And the gases that are measured are methane and methane and hydrogen. And so basically, your client, if they go for a test like this, will ingest a sugary liquid high in one of those carbohydrates, and then they will breathe into a little tube with a bag. So through this test, their doctor can diagnose them with SIBO. They can address the severity of SIBO, so it measures the amount of gas being produced by these bacteria. And yeah, they can also determine, you know, if it's a fructose that they drank, they can determine whether they're able to absorb or tolerate the fructose, or they can do it with lactose. It's important to know that glucose is used to test for SIBO and has been used for years in Europe. It is actually preferred to lactulose. And so they found that they get the exact same results, whether they give the person glucose or they give them lactulose. They get the same numbers on the test. Both breath testing. The glucose results equal the lactulose results in most cases. And there's a producer of these tests called Quintron, and those seem to be the most reliable based on my research. And so breath testing, they can calibrate their machines. Basically, they get these samples and they put them through a machine. Many labs will calibrate their machines daily. So if your client is going to go through with this kind of testing, you can go ahead and phone the lab and see what kind of machine they use. Is it a Quintron test? Do they calibrate their machines daily? And feel empowered to go ahead and ask these questions on the behalf of your client. It's important to note that some of the foods that are recommended in preparation for this breath test are not ideal. And also important to note that these bacteria can double every half hour in an ideal situation. So under the ideal conditions, bacteria can double every half hour. And so if we're feeding them on a three-hour test, there are going to be repercussions to that. So if your client is already having a lot of discomfort and a lot of gas and bloating, see whether or not it's really the best thing for them to do this. And just be aware of the risks. Another thing that people will try is the low FODMAP food trial, which is often an alternative to breath testing. So rather than doing the test, they will just test out the foods and see what bothers them. So you got to find the system that works best for you and for your client. Some people prefer to avoid just the fructose and lactose at first, and some people will just cut out all of the foods that contain the highest amount of FODMAPs. Nobody digests the oligosaccharides. Again, those are those like inulin, the fructooligosaccharides, and the great prebiotics. So best to avoid them on this kind of trial. Fruits might be included if they are not producing gas. So basically the idea is to take everything out and to add things back one at a time and see which foods are triggered. On this slide, it mentions to add back categories. So add back the ones that are the highest in the oligosaccharides first, or add back the ones that are the highest in fructose first, and then kind of add back category by category. But as we discussed, foods don't easily fit into categories. So it'll be a variety of carbohydrates in all of these foods. And what I find to be more helpful is to add them back food by food. But of course, it depends on your client's willingness to do this. So you might want to do a group of foods or do one food at a time. The reason I like to do one at a time is because this is so often mixed up in dysbiosis and food intolerance and unknown allergies and oxalate issues. It's all just a big bunch of things all glomped in together, that their reactions to these different foods are going to be so individual, and there's going to be no explanation for it sometimes, and it's just so much easier to have clarity to add a food, wait 3 or 4 days, and then add another one if your client has the patience for that. Okay, so how to implement this FODMAP trial? There would be the elimination phase, which is really designed to be like for 2 weeks, and then starting to add foods back in, which is called the provocation phase. So we're sort of innocent until proven guilty, and we're proven guilty by if we start taking a food again, and it produces gas or bloating within the first 3 hours, that's what I say, after eating, there you go, it's guilty. So if it's not tolerated, you would eliminate it from the diet and then move on to the next food or the next category. FODMAP reactions, again, can be cumulative. So think in the amount of FODMAPs per meal rather than in a food necessarily. Because people will eat meals of different sizes with different amounts of different things in them. So have your client really think about the total FODMAPs in their meal. It's important to know, again, that oils of these high FODMAP foods are fine. Because these carbohydrates are water-soluble, you know, if you can do an infusion of any of these things, that will be safe for them. FODMAPs with dysbiosis. So really, the safest place to start it to do an elimination like this would be to combine the SCD gaps and low FODMAP diet and go from there, slowly adding things back in. To follow a customized dietary and herbal protocol, including repopulation with good probiotics for 8 to 12 weeks. And being careful to see gas, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, and other symptoms improving. The breath test can be repeated after 90 days, and it's a good, you know, it's a good measurement. So if they took the breath test and then you want them to test again and just see if those levels are going down, if they're going to go that way. Improving FODMAP tolerance. So removing high FODMAP foods to stop feeding the wrong bacteria temporarily can be a good idea. And addressing the bacterial overgrowth with a customized protocol is a good idea too. Along with this, we want to improve small intestinal motility. We want to repopulate the gut with proper probiotics for each client. Sometimes steaming or cooking and pureeing foods can help to improve tolerance, especially when everything is already sort of irritated and quite sensitive in there. And then you want to test back the categories or the individual foods over time. Improving small intestinal motility is key here. And as we know, these motility issues can be caused by a variety of factors, by nutrient deficiencies, by bacteria and yeast that are living in the small intestine, by just having the wrong environment in there, spinal misalignment, nervous system issues. So it's important to reduce Clostridia, E. coli, H. pylori, Klebsiella, Citrobacter, and other dysbiotic bacteria with an affinity for the small intestine. It's important to increase beneficial lactobacillus bacteria, such as Plantarum, Fermentum, Bulgaricus, and Bacillus bacteria, including Subtilis and Clausii. So those have been shown to reduce small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and improve motility. It's important to support adrenal health with stress and with adrenal depletion, digestion is going to, you know, decrease. It's important to investigate thyroid hormones. With low thyroid hormones, motility can be quite an issue. It's important to support liver health and bile production. Bile is our natural prokinetic, okay? Really important to be producing enough bile. Investigate dehydration, aka get your client to drink water and get them to sleep on an empty stomach. And the reason why I'm not saying stop eating 3 hours before bed is because, hey, if motility is slow, there's still going to be food in the small intestine maybe 3-5 hours after they eat. I don't know. So this is going to be super individual, but the important thing is that when they go to bed, there's no food in there. The small intestine needs to be, you know, like an empty space that is more of an alkaline pH and is empty most of the time, basically, especially when sleeping. So support sleep for your clients. Help them resolve any candida or accompanying blood sugar issues, because candida can really slow motility. Address anything that's, you know, misaligned. Have them see a chiropractor if that's not your specialty. Support the nervous system with good nutrition. Cannot be overstated. Right. So here are some really cool bacteria for small intestinal motility. So we want to reduce, again, Clostridia, E. coli, H. pylori, Klebsiella, Citrobacter, and other dysbiotic bacteria that can make it too acidic in there and change the place. We want to increase Plantarum, Fermentum, and Vulgaricus. The Bacillus subtilis and Bacillus clausii, those can be found in soil-based probiotics like Megaspore. Okay, so here are some pros and cons of the low FODMAP diet. The pros are that it can be effective in reducing bacterial overgrowth symptoms. It can be effective for relief of IBS, you know, when it's just not clear what's going on, and there's alternating diarrhea and constipation, and gas and bloating, and I mean, that is really what the diet was developed for. The cons are that it may not alone be enough to resolve SIBO or irritable bowel, and it adds another level of dietary restriction, which is the understatement of the year. In doing this, really important to support your clients and help them to understand that there is no effective FODMAP diet that you can just give them, and that it is a matter of trial and error, and that it will have to be individualized. Although some good places to start are the GRAND program, Julie Matthews, Bio-Individual Nutrition Institute, and Allison C. Becker, she's got some great FODMAP food charts, but again, they're a good starting point, but will have to be customized for your clients. Got some references here for you. And thank you.
Great job, Steph. Thank you. And as everybody can see from what you said, this is a good starting point, and that there's no one FODMAP diet. There's a lot of people who are out there going, I'm on a low FODMAP diet. I can't eat this, can't eat that. And the importance of testing and the importance of just really personalizing it, because the biggest thing is people are feeling really restricted. You talk about oxalates, you talk about FODMAPs, you talk about gluten, you talk about dairy, you talk about, I mean, you just get to the point where they don't have any clue what to eat. And we really don't, we want to take the theories, right? The theories, the science behind it, and say, okay, let's do, like you said, let's do the testing. Let's just pull things out and then add them back in and find out where that mode of tolerance is, because it could drive somebody nuts to take out all these foods, because all of the good foods are in these categories, right? All of our healthy, whole plant foods that are loaded with nutrition. And so you don't really want to do this for a long period of time. But it really goes back to fixing the underlying cause, right? The diet is helpful because there's an underlying pathology, because there's dysbiosis, because there's poor gut motility, because, you know, maybe they had surgery, maybe they've been eating sugar their whole life. There's just a lot of reasons for that. So I think of FODMAPs as a temporary solution while you're working on the underlying problem, right? So that's why I really appreciate all this information. And it's a good starting point. Yeah. And you want to work with people and get them out of their paranoia, get them out of their religious fervor about different diets, and because they get so scared to eat anything. And that's where we come in. So,
Well, it's wrong focus. It's focus on the diet rather than focus on the body. And it's really important to know that FODMAP foods did not cause SIBO.
Exactly.
Onions did not cause your client's SIBO.
Exactly.
It is an underlying condition of imbalance in the body, wrong environment in the small intestine, low motility, maybe ileocecal valve irritation, something else is going on that you need to help them solve.
Right. They're not damaging in and of themselves, unlike certain other foods like hydrogenated fats and, you know, things like that. And, and pure sugar without the good food is certainly a problem.
Right.
But it's really identifying what are the good foods that cause problems because of an underlying issue versus what are the bad foods that nobody should be eating anyway. And then helping them to get rid of those damaging foods while they temporarily look at reducing some of these other things. So that's what's really important, because people can go nuts and then they just go back to Twinkies because it's too hard. Broccoli causes me pain. Twinkies don't. I'm going to eat Twinkies.
Yep.
So thank you very much for a great presentation. And this is Dr. Reed and Steph.
Bye.
Great job. because it is something, you know, I really can't emphasize that enough. You hear it all the time. Like, they can't eat this, they can't eat that. What can I eat? And how long? I've been on a low FODMAP diet for 3 years and it's not helping. Okay, well, you're not supposed to be on it for 3 years. And that's what we really need to get across for people. It's a temporary job, it's a temporary diet for while you're figuring it out. And it's a clue if they say every time I eat cauliflower and broccoli, my gut swells up. And a lot of it's differentiating between food allergies versus sensitivities to certain components in the food.